This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Gibbon. In her freshman season, Madison Roberts had an immediate impact on the University of California, Berkeley women's lacrosse team.
I'm a bit of a world-class hair braider.
Yeah, Madison braids her teammates' hair.
If you've ever played on a women's athletic team, this is a very crucial skill to have around.
As a sophomore, though, Madison began to think more about her role off the field.
If I'm going to have to braid hair, I'm going to make it count for something.
Only a Game's Matthew Stock has the story.
Gail Roberts says her daughter Madison has always brought a sense of activism to the lacrosse field.
You know, everyone would bring a bunch of water bottles.
The disposable kind.
Sometimes people would leave them on the field. She was very conscious of that and picking them up after the games and would say, you know, let's get a really good water bottle. If you're unhappy with something, she would say, okay, do something about it.
Gail says social consciousness runs in the family. Her own father taught her the importance of voting, and she passed on those lessons to Madison and her siblings.
Back when they were little, you know, there was still like a voting booth that had a curtain, and she'd be like, can I go with you? Can I come with you? And so would her twin brother and her other siblings, but she particularly, I think, really enjoyed it. And, you know, I'd lift them up and read off the names and who I planned to vote for and that it was important just to vote, and she would pull the lever or hit the button for me, and they would give her a little sticker. I voted. You know, it was very sweet and very touching.
Madison continued to learn about civic engagement through extracurriculars in high school. When she was 18, she spent the day of the 2014 midterm elections volunteering at her precinct.
She loved it. She came home really jazzed about the people were great, and it was so neat to see a big turnout, and very much a positive thing for her.
So when she got tired of braiding hair for her college teammates, Madison took a new approach.
I was like, you know, I'm a sophomore now. Like, I don't have to just braid hair. I remember us just being at a fall ball tournament in Seattle, and it was pouring rain outside, and I was like, yeah, I'll braid your hair, but you have to prove to me register to vote, and if you already are, go ask a teammate to register, and then I'll do it.
Madison's teammates didn't seem to think much of it at the time. Madison was known for this kind of thing. But this fall, she decided to ramp up her voter registration efforts. She asked her head coach what more she could do.
She was like, put together a presentation, show me what you're going to do, and I'll give you time on Friday. We all gathered in our locker room. I told everyone to bring their laptop.
Madison took a poll at the start of the team meeting. She found that only 40% of her teammates were registered to vote.
And honestly, that's not out of the ordinary for a group of young women, 18 to 22. So I wasn't shocked by it. I more felt excited that I had this opportunity to make an impact on 60% of my team.
Madison began with a disclaimer. This wasn't politically motivated.
I could care less what your opinion is, so much as I want you to have one and feel invested and feel motivated to use your voice.
She showed her team data from recent elections and explained that while young people make up a third of the electorate, less than half showed up to vote in the most recent national election.
From there, I shared the links that people needed for every single state. I think within 30 minutes, I had all 35 of my teammates either registered to vote, or if they already were registered, they got time to print their absentee ballots. And I got Cal Athletics to reimburse me to buy stamps and envelopes so people were able to send those out. And they were like, honestly, I wouldn't have done this without you. I kind of realized if I just get hands-on with people and walk them through this, show them the right links, they're going to do the right thing and move in the right direction.
Madison reached out to the rest of the head coaches at Cal. Several of them invited her to speak to their teams about the importance of voting. Since then, she's also organized registration tables at Cal volleyball and football games. She's often seen walking around campus wearing her Cal Athletics backpack.
Whenever I'm wearing my gear, I'm very conscious of the community that I'm representing and not perpetrating negative stereotypes about dumb jocks. The best way I can think of to counter those stereotypes is by just being the opposite of them.
Madison has lacrosse practice and conditioning for several hours every day. She goes to class, does her schoolwork, interns with a bike share program, and helps on a research project about low-income housing. And on top of all of that, she's gone all in on getting out the vote on campus.
When something matters to you, you make time for it. And I really want to see kids my age feel empowered and feel like their voice matters and get them activated. We are a little bit more invested in what's happening right now, but I think we're super likely to go post about it on social media or complained about it to a friend and then not actually do something about it. And here our political system is set up to give you a voice. And how cool is that?
That story came from Only a Game's Matthew Stock. Depending on where you live, there may still be time for you to register to vote. We'll link to more info at onlyagame.org. And if you are registered and haven't voted early like I did, head to the polls on Tuesday to cast your ballot. We mean it. If you haven't voted yet, you really should head to the polls on Tuesday. And here's another way you can make your voice heard. You can cast your vote for Only a Game from your couch or while walking your dog with just a couple of taps on your phone. Subscribe to Only a Game on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. And while you're there, leave us a review. You can pitch us a story for an upcoming show or tell us about a recent roundtable guest that you really liked. Your vote for Only a Game will help other listeners find our show. It's time for three stories you should know.
My first love
will be basketball.
We don't usually start this segment with a commercial for a wealth management service, but here goes. In the ad that dropped this week, a boy and girl compare their future basketball accomplishments, and it doesn't go well for the boy.
In college, I'll be third team All-American.
First team All-American, three times.
Two Final Fours.
Three straight Final Fours. Back to back to back.
I'll be Big East second team.
Big East player of the year.
Until...
My rookie contract, $4 million.
My rookie contract will be $40,000.
Ouch. I'm joined this week by The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and NBC Sports Boston's Kyle Draper. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Karen.
Hi, Karen.
The WNBA players opted out of their contract this week. That means that the current CBA will expire after the 2019 season. Players are not asking to be paid on par with NBA players, but they are asking for better working conditions, more marketing to help the league grow, and access to the league's books so that they can better assess how much they deserve to be paid. All of this seems pretty reasonable to me. NBA players share in half of that league's revenue. Best estimates suggest that the women earn about 20%. And I know that the WNBA brings in less money, which means a larger percentage of the revenue goes towards just keeping the lights on. But at the very least, the league needs to sit down and show the women why it can't pay them the kind of money they earn playing overseas during the WNBA offseason. Playing in the WNBA shouldn't be a side gig, and the league will never grow unless they treat their superstars like superstars. Rachel, are you with me?
I am. I think that the league certainly doesn't have much to lose by opening the CBA because the last time I checked, I think that the minimum WNBA salary was about 1/10 of the minimum NBA salary. So they're really not gambling a whole lot from where I sit to ask for it to be reopened. And we're really living in the golden age of sports unions. You know, the NFL, the NBA, certainly Major League Baseball has always had a very strong union. So it makes sense that the WNBA would take a cue and fight for its rights.
Well, as you guys know, I mean, whether it's in basketball, football, baseball, whatever the sport is, in my opinion, the product is the athletes on the field. And so we are seeing it in the NBA with LeBron James taking control of his situation, his free agency situation. And it's wonderful to see the women banding together because it's not just about money. It's also about working conditions. It's about marketing. The fact that these teams have to travel commercial flights, to me, is ridiculous. These are international superstars, and they should be treated as such. And so there's clearly something going on here. And like you said, we should see the books opened up. It's a shame that they're not. What does the WNBA have to hide? And so, I think this is a win for the players. And if they stay together, I think we will see some changes.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the math is really unknown. But I find myself thinking, well, if these players aren't underpaid, why wouldn't you open up the books? Rachel, what do you have for us?
Well, the reigning women's champions of the Boston-New York Marathons will line up for the New York Marathon on Sunday. And for the first time in decades, they're both American. But American women are not the fastest marathoners. Kenyans and Ethiopians still clock the fastest times. Des Linden won Boston by slogging through terrible weather while others dropped out. And Shalane Flanagan won New York last year when the Kenyan Mary Kitani, who'd won it three times earlier, had a bad race. So should we care that the U.S. women aren't the fastest in the world if they're finding ways to gut out these races and win?
I think it's more impressive that they are gutting it out, because when you look at, you know, marathon runners, traditionally the Americans aren't viewed as the fastest in the world. And so to me, they're beating the odds, they're overcoming the obstacles, you know, overcoming the doubters. To me, that speaks more.
Yeah, I don't think fans care whether their runners are the fastest or whether they're using pace setters or whatever. Fans just care about winning. Yeah. They don't care if it's an ugly win. In fact, if it's an ugly win, they say, our runner is the toughest, right? And I've been to Kenya. I've hung with running fans there, and they say our runners are the smartest. They know to use pace setters. They know to train in a certain way, and they're the best because they're the smartest and the fastest. So I think everybody just really likes to win.
There's nothing wrong with that, right? There's nothing wrong with winning.
Hey, this is a front-running culture, absolutely, in the U.S. And one of the reasons why the American women are doing so well is because they and some of the American men have copied the Kenyans and Ethiopians and having these training groups, these elite training groups that run and train together and make themselves better. East Africans have done this for decades, and more recently the U.S. has adopted this and made some progress.
Kyle, it's your turn, and I know you have a controversial one for
us. Yeah, this is one that should be the front page of every major newspaper in America. As you guys know, the Boston Red Sox won their fourth World Series title in the last 15 years. It's sort of becoming title town, understand that, but there seems to be some new phenomena, some new traditions being done at these celebration parades. Here in Boston, a 19-year-old fan threw a can of beer and actually hit Alex Cora and his daughter as they were going by on the championship float. I'm all for celebrating. I'm all for partying. And maybe this is my get off my lawn segment here, my get off my lawn take. But when fans are throwing beers at players, there's another guy, he broke part of the World Series trophy.
Right. And they're throwing them because they want them to drink because they want them
to drink. Not they're mad at them or anything like that. And the players get into it. But I think maybe we've gone just a little bit too far. When a manager and his daughter gets hit, when the World Series trophy gets broken and damaged, maybe there needs to be some unwritten rules. You know, baseball is the sport of unwritten rules, right? Maybe there needs to be unwritten rules when it comes to celebrating championships. No throwing beer. I don't understand when that became cool. You know, it doesn't seem cool to me.
Rachel? Maybe this is just a case of Boston not being able to have nice things. You know, I remember way back in the day when my Minnesota Twins won their first World Series in 1987. And, you know, we got out of school. It was amazing. And there were something between 400,000 and a million people lining the streets of the Twin Cities to greet our heroes. And I think there was maybe one arrest for a guy who ripped a license plate off a police car. And that was it. I mean, it was bliss, of course. You know, Minnesota is not accustomed to this many parades, so maybe people were just too blissed out to cause any damage.
That may have been the last one, right?
Well, 91. Yeah, 91, the Twins won again, and I think there was a parade, but it certainly was not on the level of 87.
You know, what's interesting is I'm a Philadelphia native, and so the Eagles had their Super Bowl parade. I don't remember beers being thrown or anything like that, but I do remember, you know, some neighbors were upset because there are no porta potties out there. And so, as you know, you start drinking beer, you start celebrating, you got to relieve yourself. And so maybe next time the Eagles or Sixers or whoever wins a title, they'll throw some porta potties out there too.
Yeah, I think the entire problem is that Boston just gets too many of these things. I mean, there is this kid, they call him the Sign Kid, which is a really dumb name, but okay, that he's the Sign Kid. He's been alive for 16 years. There have been 11 championship parades in his lifetime. He's been to 8 of them. And I think people are just trying to one-up themselves. I mean, personally, I am tired of riding the commuter rail with revelers who are drunk at 7:30 in the morning.
And on Halloween at that this year, right?
Right. Like, come on, Boston. This isn't your first rodeo. You should know the pitfalls of championship parading by now.
Act like you've been there before, right? That's what they say.
Also, what would Emily Post have to say about throwing a full beer at someone to invite him to drink it? I mean, this is not how you're supposed to do things.
Those are like deadly weapons, right? You know, you should be drinking it. Let the players do their champagne thing.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
And Kyle Draper of NBC Sports Boston. Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you, Karen.
In the fall of 2016, Alex Blackwell suffered a concussion while playing club soccer. As she recovered, her parents noticed something they weren't expecting: changes to Alex's personality.
Very subtle changes over weeks and months that we believe began somewhere around the first of the year, about 2 to 3 months after the concussion.
That story's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This message comes from Only a Game sponsor, Samuel Adams. Of all the beers Sam Adams has ever brewed, Boston Lager is their all-time favorite. With its distinctive balance of spicy hops, sweet roasted malts, and smooth finish, it stood the test of time and helped launch the whole craft beer revolution. Sam Adams Boston Lager. Full-flavored, rich, and complex. There's nothing quite like the taste of an original. Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor responsibly.
Dr. Larry Nassar abused his patients for decades.
I do remember telling the nurse, "What if everyone thinks I'm lying?"
Believed, a new podcast from Michigan Radio and NPR, looks at how a team of women put one of the worst serial sexual abusers behind bars.
I'm Karen Given. Richard Blackwell is a software engineer from Atlanta, soccer referee, father of two. Last September, in the middle of the night, there was a knock at Richard's door. He was surprised.
Who's not surprised by a pounding on their front door, an insistent pounding on their front door, and then to look out and see the police are standing out front?
This is probably a good time to mention that parts of Richard's story are difficult to hear. It might not be for everyone. One of those difficult moments happened as soon as Richard opened his front door.
"You know, officer, what's going on?" He said, "Sir, do you have a 16-year-old daughter? If so, you need to check on her." And I left him standing at the door and raced up the stairs. I think I yelled "Alex" as I ran up the stairs.
Richard's wife, Kim, was right behind him.
We got to her room. Her door was cracked and her bedside lamp was on. She was laying on her pillows asleep with her laptop open. Only she wasn't asleep.
Richard, Kim, and the police officer started CPR.
We knew the event for what it was. There was a letter laying on her bed. Of course, at this moment, we didn't have time to read that, but it was real clear what had happened.
The story of Alex Blackwell's life begins 16 years before it ended. She was Richard and Kim's first child, and from a very young age, she had a lot of energy.
She began walking at 6 months. She wasn't a big fan of sleeping either. So at 4:30 in the morning, if Dora the Explorer came on, she wanted to be there watching it.
But when Alex was two, her parents noticed something was wrong. Her legs were starting to bow.
Like a cowboy on TV.
Doctors diagnosed Alex with Blount's disease, a growth disorder that causes the legs to bow out just below the knees. It happens sometimes with kids who walk early. To bring her muscles and bones back into alignment, doctors put Alex's legs in braces.
And she wore those for, gosh, probably a year. She wanted out of them so badly, but she learned to run in them. She would go busting by, clank, 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 clank. Not unlike the movie Forrest Gump. Yes, Forrest Gump was the same thing. And when Alex came out of those leg braces, she was a speed demon, and that began her sports career.
Alex found herself at a disadvantage against taller girls in swimming and basketball, but she was just the right size for soccer. Her sister discovered the same thing. She's 2 years younger.
Alex was a bit of an introvert. Her sister Grayson is an extrovert. Both of them very sports capable.
When it became clear that both of his girls were going to excel at soccer, Richard became a referee and started working his way up the ranks. That's when he realized something that, in retrospect, gives him cause for concern.
Soccer is a much more aggressive sport, I think, than a lot of people think. When you're on the field and you're not 100 yards away like the parents and the coaches, you see these things up close. And soccer is not unlike football in the type of contact that you have, or hockey.
Alex's first concussion didn't happen on the soccer field. She hit her head on a friend's open locker, fell down, and hit her head again. She was in seventh grade.
I'm not sure we saw anything that concerned us other than it was several months before we felt she was fully recovered.
Alex's second concussion came during the 2016 club soccer season.
Alex was a center forward, and one of her favorite moves was to slide into the ball and crush it into the goal. But that's also a sort of a backwards motion, just like sliding into home plate. She slid backwards and hit her head as she did. But at the time we were at the game, it didn't seem remarkable to us. A week later, she had another match. Similar type thing, and she said it hurt when she hit. Again, it was unremarkable at the time, but later that night she started having headaches, and the headaches were getting worse and worse and worse. So we took her to get her checked out, and they said that there appeared to be a prior injury of a week or two back. And Alex responded, yeah, I did hit my head, and I was okay.
The head injuries happened in the fall of 2016, and as the initial concussion symptoms, headaches, nausea, brain fog, started to fade, Richard and Kim noticed something they weren't expecting to see, changes to Alex's personality.
Very subtle changes over weeks and months that we believe began somewhere around the first of the year, about 2 to 3 months after the concussion.
Alex had always been an introvert, so at first, Richard didn't think much of it, but it kept getting worse. She was fine hanging out one-on-one, but she felt uncomfortable when her friends wanted her to join them in groups.
And it got to a point of where she just stopped, and she would say, no, I'm not going. I don't want to.
Alex was diagnosed with mild depression and social anxiety. She was prescribed medications and started seeing a therapist regularly. And then came the next blow.
So the Blount's disease turned back around, and she was beginning to have knee problems. And she needed to either quit sports or have the surgery. And we left that to her.
Alex had already decided that she wanted to be a doctor someday. Her future was academic, not athletic. But Richard says she was looking forward to playing on her high school soccer team. They were expected to go back to the state championship. Alex wanted to be a part of that. So she chose surgery. Doctors told Richard that the procedure was nothing to worry about.
Oh, yeah, we're going to saw her bone in half and twist her ankle around 10 degrees, and then we'll screw it back together and it'll be fine. Nothing to it. We do it all the time. But
it takes my breath away.
But that's what they did. As it turns out, as you can imagine, there was a lot of pain associated with that.
Doctors operated on one leg and then the other, which meant that Alex was in a wheelchair or on crutches for the next 6 months. Richard says Alex craved the endorphin release that comes with exercise. She longed to join her teammates on the field and not just on the sidelines. And while doctors at the time did not connect Alex's depression and social anxiety to the concussions she suffered, her father now knows they played a role.
Looking back now with much more clarity, as best I can do just 1 year after the fact, there were a number of factors. I believe if we could have taken any one of those out, we might not be having this conversation today.
Late in the summer of 2017, Alex told her therapist that she'd been thinking about suicide.
That becomes, of course, a red alert event for any therapist.
Doctors quickly diagnosed the problems. They blamed a change in her prescription. They cited her lack of exercise and her eating habits.
These were all things that they were very comfortable that they could adjust.
Were you reassured?
Very much so, yes. Alex was telling us that, yes, this is a big difference. I'm much better now.
That brings us back to September 2017. Alex's school was closed for a couple of days as Atlanta recovered from Hurricane Irma. Alex was at home.
And I walked by her bedroom, and she was sitting on her bed with her laptop open and her headphones on, listening to music. And she saw me walk by her door, and she pulled her headphones up, and I said, "You okay?" And she says, "Yeah, I'm okay, Dad."
And how much later was the knock on your door?
That was about 5 in the evening, and the knock was around 1:30 in the morning.
Alex had been talking to her boyfriend on the phone. He's the one who called for help. By the time Richard and his wife found her, she wasn't breathing and had no pulse. Richard and Kim performed CPR until the ambulance arrived just a few minutes later. Alex was rushed to the hospital. For 2 hours, Richard watched as a team of doctors and nurses tried to bring his 16-year-old daughter back.
But they came to a point where they had exhausted every drug that they could give her, and the staff was physically exhausted. And just like that, they looked up and there's nothing that prepares a parent for that moment.
Richard says the sun was just coming up when he and Kim drove home. They were in shock. He doesn't remember much from the next day.
I think we dozed off a little bit during the night, but around 5 a.m., I couldn't lay in bed anymore. And I was beginning to feel this, I say the word compulsion, a need to write down what happened. I felt that I needed to tell this story right now.
Richard sat down at his desk and wrote a warning to other parents. He was open about how Alex had died. He mentioned her concussions while playing soccer and called for better protections for young athletes. Richard gave his essay a title, "Is Your Daughter Okay? Check Again." He posted it on LinkedIn. He's never been active on Facebook or Twitter, and a lot of people noticed.
In some ways, I think it was therapy for me, but I also felt that Alex was nearby. And each time that I talk, including today, I reach out and ask her, "Alex, help me share your words." I think she does.
Richard sometimes finds himself at his computer, unable to focus on work. That's when he researches all the things he didn't know while Alex was alive. He studies the link between concussions and mental health. He reads scientific studies on experimental treatments for depression. He advocates. He rallies. Meanwhile, Richard's younger daughter, Grayson, has choices of her own to make.
Does your other daughter still play soccer?
We don't know. She has not made it to a practice yet. Every Monday and Wednesday, she said, "I'm going to practice tonight, Dad." "Okay." And each evening, some event comes up. So we're not sure.
When I first started talking to Richard, I thought this was a story about soccer, about how concussions are more prevalent than parents realize, about calls to limit headers, about whether head protection could help. But soccer is only part of the story. Alex was a speed demon. There's only so much that could have been done to keep her safe on the soccer field. And as much as it seems like a story about suicide, Richard says it's not that either. He doesn't talk about Alex's death to raise awareness about suicide. He does it because he hopes to help people change the way they think about depression. Alex was embarrassed by the stigma of her depression diagnosis. She was embarrassed to be having thoughts of suicide. But maybe she didn't have to be. Maybe that is something that can be fixed. So Richard shares Alex's words as often as he can. And by sharing the words of his daughter, who wanted to be a doctor, Richard Blackwell is starting to heal.
I can laugh a little bit now that I couldn't 6 months ago.
That's good.
We are so much better. And we're moving ahead. Because what else can you do? Well, I'll tell you what else you can do. You can recognize it for what it was, and you can do everything you can to help other families avoid where we are today. And that's what we're doing.
If you or somebody you know might need help, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Adam Greenberg is running for Connecticut State Senate, and he's used to getting strange looks when he tells voters he played Major League Baseball.
Once I start getting that, I'm like, I'm the guy. And they look at me and they're like, you're the guy? Yep, I'm the guy that got hit.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, Valentino Dixon spent 27 years in jail after a wrongful murder conviction. He's out now, thanks in part to his love of a sport he's never actually played. But now Charlie Pierce joins me for a look at the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
We spoke last week of the miss at Maryland, the toxic miss, if you will. This week, Maryland announced that head football coach DJ Durkin would not be fired. In unrelated news, the university president would be retiring. Then the university president announced that Durkin was fired after all. Explain, please.
Yes. Last week, we talked about the toxic mess at the University of Maryland, which this week, against all odds, became more toxic and a bigger mess. I don't know what they're doing down there, but it appears that the tipping point came when the players all got together and said, we're just not going to play for this guy.
Yeah.
Anytime college athletes assert their rights against the people who are exploiting them for a lot of money, they get a cheer from me. They brought Durkin back for, 48 hours or something. Then they fired him, but they brought back the training staff who carried out the orders that ended up with a guy being dead. These people clearly don't know what they're doing.
Among those who were outraged by the university's original decision not to fire Durkin was the Student Government Association. They had planned a rally with support from college Democrats and college Republicans. Finally, something both sides of the aisle
could
agree
on. Yeah, within shouting distance of Washington, bipartisanship. Wow, let's get rid of him. You know, and at bottom, the state of the case is a guy died.
Right.
And a guy died because of a stupid macho football coach's decision not to look at warning signs. And that should be the lesson. That should be the lesson for all football players at major programs. You don't have to put up with this sort of stuff. You don't have to risk your lives for some alumni wearing a camellia in Section 355.
Charlie, the Boston Red Sox have won another World Series.
Yes, they have!
I have said it a few times this fall. The city of Boston did not need another championship, so I don't want to talk about what it means to the city of Boston. But I would like to talk about what it means to Puerto Rico.
Yeah, this is Alex Cora has turned into a legitimate national kind of superstar. He's determined he's going to bring the trophy to Puerto Rico. He went out of his way afterwards to shout out to the island. He magically did everything right as a baseball manager for the last month and a half.
You know, it's now part of Red Sox mythology that the only thing that Alex Cora asked for when he agreed to come to Boston was a plane filled with supplies for Puerto Rico. And now I kind of expect that someone's going to write a ballad for him or maybe an epic poem.
Yeah,
or something.
I think he deserves at least a folk song. Yeah.
Hall of Famer Willie McCovey died this week. He played 19 seasons with the San Francisco Giants. Do you have any Willie McCovey stories to
tell? Well, I have the one memory everybody my age has, which is him almost winning the World Series in 1962, but hitting a screaming line drive right at Bobby Richardson of the Yankees. McCovey, obviously, he played in the shadow of Willie Mays, so he never got the credit. I mean, I think if you bet 100 people in a bar whether or not Willie McCovey hit 500 home runs, you'd probably win the money from 58 of them. He actually did. He was a great baseball player. And a measure of how the game has changed, he was 6'4", and people called him Stretch. He was a tall baseball player. Everybody's 6'4" now.
Derrick Rose scored 50 points on Wednesday night, and I feel like I have to repeat that. Derrick Rose, who plays for the Minnesota Timberwolves, scored 50 points on Wednesday night. Were you as surprised as everyone else?
I was surprised. I'm a little bit nauseated by the Derrick Rose comeback narrative that sprung up around him, since one of the things he's coming back from is a sexual assault case, which is still under adjudication. But this is a guy who was capable, before the injuries hit, of doing this. I'm going to spare the rest of our listeners the redemption narrative beyond that. And I think, you know, other players like LeBron James should shut up about why he's still a superhero. And Tom Thibodeau saying he has courage, humility, and character. It remains to be seen how much character the guy really has.
Cleveland coach Tyronn Lue was fired last weekend after the Cavs started their LeBron-less season 0-6. But this is the same guy who coached that team to three straight Eastern Conference championships. And it's not Lue's fault that LeBron went to L.A. Does this firing make any sense?
In the context of why professional coaches get fired, yeah, it makes sense. They started off 0-6. It doesn't look like it's going to get any better. And the coach is always the scapegoat in that situation. In the logic that exists in the real world, having lost one of the two or three greatest players of all time and having worked for a management that put nothing in there to alleviate that possibility, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. Tyronn Lue will find another place to coach.
Earlier this week, while his team was still 0-6, Oakland Raiders coach John Gruden said that he gets a lot of calls from people dying to play for his team. That was before they lost again on Thursday night. I'm wondering if those people are currently unemployed or maybe they just haven't looked at the NFL standings.
Oh, it's entirely possible that they're actually dying. Right now, Oakland is playing like the dead. John Gruden is going to wind up a laughingstock if he isn't one already. He should have stayed in the broadcast booth, which is a great gig, by the way. I don't know why anybody ever leaves, because he's going to go about 2-14 this year.
And finally, Charlie, 22 years ago, in a reserve game between Manchester United and Liverpool, Andy Cole broke both his legs. The defender on that play, a man named Neil Ruddock, now says that he intentionally caused the injury. But don't worry, it's not as bad as it sounds, right?
No, because he only meant to break one leg. This is one of the unsolved mysteries of the sports world. Did Neil the Razor Ruddock really mean to break both his legs, or was it just a plan that went awry? Apparently, it was a plan that went awry.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
In what I think is fair to say is a first in the 25-year history of Only a Game, we're going to close out this week's show by dropping in on the state Senate race in Connecticut's 12th district. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
This is what it sounds like trying to keep up with Republican state Senate candidate Adam Greenberg on the campaign trail.
They can't quite get the dramatic effect on the radio.
Greenberg definitely isn't the first or only candidate to run up and down driveways to knock on as many doors as possible, but he's probably faster than most.
You were known for your speed, right?
Yep. Good luck.
He was. The 37-year-old Greenberg spent 12 years playing professional baseball. One season, he stole 53 bases. But even more than his speed, Adam Greenberg's baseball career is defined by a single moment. If it hadn't happened, he might not be running for office now. And he says it comes up every day he's out campaigning.
I mean, I always say, I'm Adam Greenberg, I'm running for state senate, I grew up here in Guilford, I live in Brantford, played Major League Baseball, and then they usually get that little look. They go, who do you play for? Once I start getting that, I'm like, I'm the guy. And they look at me and they're like, you're the guy? Yep, I'm the guy that got hit.
Back on July 7th, 2005, Adam Greenberg's baseball career wasn't yet tied to a single play. He was a 24-year-old outfielder in the Chicago Cubs organization, a promising prospect on the team's AA affiliate, the Diamond Jacks. On this particular evening, Greenberg and his club wrapped up a series in Kodak, Tennessee.
And the team that I was on, they were going down to Jacksonville, Florida on a, my God, 12-hour bus ride. And myself and Matt Merton, who were two outfielders on the team, were told you're going to stay behind and you might get a call to go to AAA, or you're going to get on a plane and fly to Jacksonville to meet the team.
So Adam and Matt were left to wait at the Days Inn. The Chicago Cubs were playing the second leg of a doubleheader. Adam and Matt turned on the game.
And we received a phone call from our agent who was representing both of us, and he said, root against the Cubs more than you've ever rooted against them in your entire life. So we didn't know why, but Matt and I started to kind of root against the Cubs.
The Cubs lost, and less than 15 minutes later, Greenberg's phone rang. It was Diamondbacks manager Bobby Dickerson.
And he said, hey, can you do me a favor and put the phone on speaker? So I did, and Matt and I were kind of huddled up around the phone, and Bobby said, hey, guys, I just want you to know you're going to be flying to meet the team in Florida. And Matt and I looked at each other like, all right, okay, I mean, whatever. And then what he said next is, you're not coming to meet us. You're going to Miami, and you guys are going to be on the Chicago Cubs.
The Cubs were scheduled to play the Florida Marlins. The next morning, Greenberg flew first class for the first time.
They could have sat me on a little prop plane in a tiny little seat with three people sitting on my lap, and I would have been happy.
When Greenberg got to his hotel room in Florida, there was a bottle of Dom Perignon waiting for him.
I'll never forget, I had my suitcase, and I always used to leave it fully packed and just take out what I needed. Because in the minors, you're always like anticipating that you're going to get a call. You're going to go somewhere. And this time, I took out all of my clothes. Because I said the first time I ever get to the big leagues is when I'm going to unpack and plan to be here.
Greenberg sat out his first game with the Cubs. He started the second game on the bench as well. But he had a feeling he was going to get a chance at the plate.
I had my bat with me basically the whole game, my batting gloves on.
Sure enough, in the ninth inning, with the Cubs up two runs, bench coach Dick Pohl called over to him.
And he just says, Greeny, get a bat, you're hitting for the pitcher. And I'm like, the bat's attached to my hands, I don't need to get that, I just need my helmet.
As he stepped to the plate, Greenberg remembers thinking, be aggressive.
Yeah, Adam Greenberg, the youngster stepping in.
I remember everything vividly.
Greenberg, a lefty, was facing left-handed pitcher Valerio De Los Santos.
I remember the ball being released.
Right away, Greenberg says it looked like the ball was headed straight at him.
The thought was, oh my God, stay in here, don't bail, because this is my first major league at bat, first pitch. I don't want to see a curveball coming over and me bailing out for strike one.
But then he realized the ball wasn't curving.
You need to get out of the way. Obviously, it was already too late, so I just turned myself into the catcher just to try anything to just get out of the way of it, and that was when it happened.
Oh my goodness!
It caught the base of the helmet. That's why the helmet went flying, and the noise was the loudest, scariest noise, almost like a shotgun, right in your ear.
Boy, that was absolutely nowhere for him to go on that fastball,
and the scariest part was my eyes rolled in the back of my head, and I grabbed my head because based on the sound and where it hit and how much it hurt, I thought my head split open. And I said two words three times. I said, stay alive, stay alive, stay alive.
The trainers rushed onto the field.
And then they sat me up, the training staff sat me up, and they started asking me a couple questions. How many fingers? And then the last question, they said, where were you 2 days ago? And I said, without batting an eye, I said, I was in the minor leagues and I'm not going back. And they all started kind of laughing and like, all right, I guess he's all right.
Greenberg thought he was too. He walked off the field. He didn't even go to the hospital. But when he woke up the next morning, light bothered him. He says he couldn't eat. He tried to watch the Cubs' next game from the dugout, but he ended up having to retreat to the clubhouse to sleep. Still, doctors thought it was just a mild concussion, and Greenberg figured he'd be back on the field in a couple days. He went to his parents' house in Connecticut and tried to recover. And then something strange happened.
I tried to sleep, and I rolled over in bed, and my eyes went uncontrollably side to side. And then what followed was a migraine-type headache for the next few hours. So it was at that moment that I'm like, I don't know what the heck's going on with me. This isn't good. And now I start looking at the timeline going, am I going to be all right? Not just in 3 days, but am I going to be okay?
Greenberg started experiencing vertigo, something he says he would struggle with for the next 2.5 years. He says his visual alignment was thrown off. He was sent to the Cubs training facility in Arizona. He eventually returned to the field, but not for the Chicago Cubs. He was back in the minors. And that next season, he batted just 209.
I wasn't the same guy.
Greenberg played in AA for the next two seasons. There were stretches when he felt like the hitter he used to be. But by the end of the 2008 season, he was out of the minors. He joined the Bridgeport Bluefish, an independent league team. It was looking like the only major league pitch Adam Greenberg would face would be the one that knocked him out of the big leagues. And because he'd been hit, Greenberg hadn't even recorded an official at-bat. Finally, in 2012, following a fan-led campaign, the Miami Marlins signed Greenberg to a one-day contract so he could get one at-bat as a major leaguer.
Swing and a miss, and he strikes out. But you know what? He made it back. He got his one at-bat, and the crowd comes to its feet again.
Greenberg retired from baseball after the 2013 season. Since then, he's been working as a motivational speaker. He wrote a book and runs a nutrition company. And he's been living in Connecticut with his wife, Lindsay, and two children.
I got knocked down, and the state of Connecticut is the same. The state of Connecticut is in a bad place. And I looked at it from that perspective of, okay, what can I do to help?
Up until 7 months ago, Greenberg says he wasn't affiliated with a party. He says he doesn't agree with either side's, quote, extreme views. But he chose to run as a Republican for a state Senate seat that's been held by Democrats since 2005. So these days, Adam Greenberg, former outfielder, is out on the campaign trail having conversations like this.
So our spending is out of control. You can't have the six highest gas tax plus tolls. You can't have 300 business or 9,000 business regulations and 300 taxes plus tolls. The cost of goods are going to go up.
And when we spoke, Greenberg didn't seem very interested in talking about President Trump.
I'm trying to run for a state office representing the 12th district. I don't really talk about anything on a federal level from a standpoint of what I'm going to be in charge or what I'm going to be trying to implement and trying to bring to politics.
Greenberg, whose signage is Cubs blue and red with a font that looks like it belongs on an old-time baseball uniform, says he often gets invited to join voters' rec league baseball and softball teams. But he declines. There hasn't been much free time ahead of Tuesday's election. This isn't exactly the place he expected to end up back in 2005 as he unpacked his suitcase in that Florida hotel room. But Adam Greenberg says he doesn't feel sorry for himself.
No. I mean, and that's not me just saying it. I really don't. Would I have loved, and I'm going to be honest, to have been a part of the Cubs World Series team? You better believe it. But that wasn't my path. So that's what I'm saying. I'm grateful for the gifts that I've been given.
That story came from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. We first read about Adam Greenberg's campaign for Connecticut State Senate in a New York Times article written by John Altavilla. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Matthew Stock. Additional help this week from Martin's dad slash chauffeur, Rod Kessler. Thanks, Rod. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. Our final word comes from Adam Greenberg, who reveals his first baseball nickname.
They called me Hoover, because Hoover the vacuum cleaner, because I had could scoop it all up.
Alrighty then. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.